He started by showing that they did not come from the radioactive materials alone. He established that they had the same mass and expected range as the H atoms that recoiled from alpha bombardment of hydrogen gas in Marsden's experiment. He admitted dry oxygen into the evacuated brass box, then carbon dioxide, and found in both cases that the H atoms coming off the radioactive source were slowed down by colliding with the atoms of those gases. Fewer scintillations showed up on the screen. Then he tried dry air. The results surprised him. Instead of decreasing the number of scintillations, as oxygen and carbon dioxide had done, dry air increased them. Doubled them, in fact. These newfound scintillations appeared to the eye to be about equal in brightness to H scintillations, Rutherford notes cautiously near the beginning of the revolutionary part 4 of his paper. He went after them. If they were H atoms, they still might be contaminants. He eliminated that possibility first. He showed that they could not be due merely to the hydrogen in water vapor, H2O. Drying the air even more thoroughly made little difference in their number. Dust might harbor H atoms like dangerous germs. He filtered the air he let into the box through long plugs of absorbent cotton, but found little change. Since the increase in H atoms occurred in air, but not in oxygen or carbon dioxide, Rutherford deduced then that it must be due either to nitrogen or to one of the other gases present in atmospheric air. And since air is 78% nitrogen, that gas appeared to be the likeliest candidate. He tested it simply by comparing scintillations from air to scintillations from pure nitrogen. The test confirmed his hunch. With pure nitrogen, the number of long-range scintillations under similar conditions was greater than in air. Finally, Rutherford established that the H atoms came, in fact, from the nitrogen and not from the radioactive source alone. And then he made his stunning announcement, couching it, as always, in the measured understatement of British science. From the results so far obtained, it is difficult to avoid the conclusion that the long-range atoms arising from collision of alpha particles with nitrogen are not nitrogen atoms, but probably atoms of hydrogen. If this be the case, we must conclude that the nitrogen atom is disintegrated. Newspapers soon published the discovery in plainer words. Sir Ernest Rutherford, headlines blared in 1919, had split the atom. It was less a split than a transmutation, the first artificial transmutation ever achieved. When an alpha particle, atomic weight 4, collided with a nitrogen atom, atomic weight 14, knocking out a hydrogen nucleus, which Rutherford would shortly propose calling a proton, the net result was a new atom of oxygen in the form of the oxygen isotope 017, 4 plus 14, minus 1.
There would hardly be enough 017 to breathe.
Only about one alpha particle in 300,000 crashed through the electrical barrier around the nitrogen nucleus to do its alchemical work. But the discovery offered a new way to study the nucleus. Physicists had been confined so far to bouncing radiation off its exterior, or measuring the radiation that naturally came out of the nucleus during radioactive decay. Now, they had a technique for probing its insides as well. Rutherford and Chadwick soon went after other light atoms to see if they also could be disintegrated, and as it turned out, many of them, boron, fluorine, sodium, aluminum, phosphorus, could. But farther along the periodic table, a barricade loomed. The naturally radioactive sources Rutherford used emitted relatively low-moving alpha particles that lacked the power to penetrate past the increasingly formidable electrical barriers of heavier nuclei. Chadwick and others at the Cavendish began to talk of finding ways to accelerate particles to higher velocities.
Rutherford, who scorned complex equipment, resisted.
Particle acceleration was, in any case, difficult to do. For a time, the newborn science of nuclear physics stalled. Besides Rutherford's crowd of boys, several individual researchers worked at the Cavendish, legatees of J.J. Thompson. One who pursued a different but related interest was a slim, handsome, athletic, wealthy experimentalist named Francis William Aston, the son of a Birmingham gunmaker's daughter and a Harborne metal merchant. As a child, Aston made picric acid bombs from soda bottle cartridges and designed and launched huge tissue paper fire balloons. As an adult, a lifelong bachelor, heir after 1908 to his father's wealth, he skied, built and raced motorcycles, played the cello, and took elegant trips around the world, stopping off in Honolulu in 1909 at 32 to learn surfing, which he thereafter declared to be the finest of all sports. Aston was one of Rutherford's regular Sunday partners at golf on the Gogs in Cambridge. It was he who announced, at the 1913 meeting of the British Association, the separation of neon into two isotopes by laborious diffusion through pipe clay. Aston trained originally as a chemist. Rontgen's discovery of X-rays turned him to physics. J.J. Thompson brought him into the Cavendish in 1910, and it was because Thompson seemed to have separated neon into two components inside a positive ray discharge tube that Aston took up the laborious work of attempting to confirm the difference by gaseous diffusion. Thompson found that he could separate beams of different kinds of atoms by subjecting his discharge tube to parallel magnetic and electrostatic fields. The beams he produced inside his tubes were not cathode rays. He was working now with rays repelled from the opposite plate, the positively charged anode. Such rays were streams of atomic nuclei stripped of their electrons, ionized. They could be generated from gas introduced into the tube, or solid materials could be coated onto the anode plate itself, in which case ionized atoms of the material would boil off when the tube was evacuated and the anode was charged. Mixed nuclei projected in a radiant beam through a magnetic field would bend into separated component beams according to their velocity, which gave a measure of their mass. An electrostatic field bent the component beams differently, depending on their electrical charge, which gave a measure of their atomic number. In this way, writes George de Hevesy, a great variety of different atoms and atomic groupings were proved to be present in the discharge tube. Aston thought hard about J.J.'s discharge tube while he worked during the war at the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough, southwest of London, developing tougher dopes and fabrics for aircraft coverings. He wanted to prove unequivocally that neon was isotopic. J.J. was still unconvinced, and saw the possibility of sorting the isotopes of other elements as well. He thought the positive ray tube was the answer. But though it was good for general surveying, it was hopelessly imprecise. By the time Aston returned to Cambridge in 1918, he had worked the problem out theoretically. He then began building the precision instrument he had envisioned. It charged a gas or a coating until the material ionized into its component electrons and nuclei and projected the nuclei through two slits that produced a knife-edge beam, like the slit-narrowed beam of light in a spectrograph. It then subjected the beam to a strong electrostatic field. That sorted the different nuclei into separated beams. The separated beams proceeded onward through a magnetic field that further sorted nuclei according to their mass, producing separated beams of isotopes. Finally, the sorted beams struck the plate holder of a camera and marked their precise locations on a calibrated strip of film. How much the magnetic field bent the separated beams, where they blackened the strip of film, determined the mass of their component nuclei to a high degree of accuracy. Aston called his invention a mass spectrograph because it sorted elements and isotopes of elements by mass, much as an optical spectrograph sorts light by its frequency. The mass spectrograph was immediately and sensationally a success. In letters to me in January and February 1920, says Bohr, Rutherford expressed his joy in Aston's work, which gave such a convincing confirmation of Rutherford's atomic model. Of 281 naturally occurring isotopes, over the next two decades, Aston identified 212. He discovered that the weights of the atoms of all the elements he measured, with the notable exception of hydrogen, were very nearly whole numbers, which was a powerful argument in favor of the theory that the elements were assembled in nature simply from protons and electrons, from hydrogen atoms, that is. Natural elements had not weighed up in whole numbers for the chemists because they were often mixtures of isotopes of different whole number weights. Aston proved, for example, as he noted in a later lecture, that neon consisted beyond doubt of isotopes 20 and 22, and that its atomic weight, 20.2, was the result of these being present in the ratio of about 9 to 1. That satisfied even J.J. Thomson. But why was hydrogen an exception? If the elements were built up from hydrogen atoms, why did the hydrogen atom itself, the elemental building block, weigh 1.008 alone? Why did it then shrink to 4 when it was packed in quartet as helium? Why not 4.032? And why was helium not exactly 4, but 4.002, or oxygen not exactly 16, but 15.994? What was the meaning of these extremely small and varying differences from whole numbers? Atoms do not fall apart, Aston reasoned. Something very powerful holds them together. That glue is now called binding energy. To acquire it, hydrogen atoms packed together in a nucleus sacrifice some of their mass. This mass defect is what Aston found when he compared the hydrogen atom to the atoms of other elements following his whole number rule. In addition, he said, nuclei may be more or less loosely packed. The density of their packing requires more or less binding energy, and that in turn requires more or less mass. Hence, the small variations. The difference between the measured mass and the whole number he expressed as a fraction, the packing fraction. Roughly, the divergence of an element from its whole number divided by its whole number. High packing fractions, Aston proposed, indicate looseness of packing, and therefore low stability. Low packing fractions, the reverse. He plotted the packing fractions on a graph and demonstrated that the elements in the broad middle of the periodic table, nickel, iron, tin, for example, had the lowest packing fractions and were therefore the most stable, while elements at the extremes of the periodic table, hydrogen at the light end, for example, uranium at the heavy, had high packing fractions and were therefore the most unstable. Locked within all the elements, he said, but most unstably so in the case of those with high packing fractions, was mass converted to energy. Comparing helium to hydrogen, nearly 1% of the hydrogen mass was missing. 4 divided by 4.032 equals 0.992 equals 99.2%. If we were able to transmute hydrogen into helium, nearly 1% of the mass would be annihilated. On the relativity equivalence of mass and energy, now experimentally proved, Aston refers here to Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared, the quantity of energy liberated would be prodigious. Thus, to change the hydrogen in a glass of water into helium would release enough energy to drive the Queen Mary across the Atlantic and back at full speed. Aston goes on in this lecture, delivered in 1936, to speculate about the social consequences of that energy release. Armed with the necessary knowledge, he says, The nuclear chemists, I am convinced, will be able to synthesize elements, just as ordinary chemists synthesize compounds. And it may be taken as certain that in some reactions, subatomic energy will be liberated. And continuing, there are those about us who say that such research should be stopped by law, alleging that man's destructive powers are already large enough. So, no doubt, the more elderly and ape-like of our prehistoric ancestors objected to the innovation of cooked food and pointed out the grave dangers attending the use of the newly discovered agency, fire. Personally, I think there is no doubt that subatomic energy is available all around us, and that one day man will release and control its almost infinite power. We cannot prevent him from doing so, and can only hope that he will not use it exclusively in blowing up his next-door neighbor. The mass spectrograph Francis Aston invented in 1919 could not release the binding energy of the atom, but with it, he identified that binding energy and located the groups of elements which, in their comparative instability, might be most likely to release it, if suitably addressed. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1922 for his work. After accepting the award alongside Niels Bohr, Stockholm has been the city of our dreams ever since, his sister, who regularly traveled with him, reminisces. He returned to the Cavendish to build larger and more accurate mass spectrographs, operating them habitually at night because he particularly detested, his sister says, various human noises, including even conversations muffled through the walls of his rooms. He was very fond of animals, especially cats and kittens, and he would go to any amount of trouble to make their acquaintance. But he didn't like dogs of the barking kind. Although Aston respected Ernest Rutherford enormously, the Cavendish director's great boom must ever have been a trial. The United States led the way in particle acceleration. The American mechanical tradition that advanced the factory and diversified the armory now extended into the laboratory as well. A congressman in 1914 had questioned a witness at an appropriations hearing. "What is a physicist?" I was asked on the floor of the House, what in the name of common sense a physicist is, and I could not answer. But the war made evident what a physicist was, made evident the value of science to the development of technology, including especially military technology, and government support and the support of private foundations were immediately forthcoming. Twice as many Americans became physicists in the dozen years between 1920 and 1932 as had in the previous 60. They were better trained than their older counterparts, at least 50 of them in Europe on National Research Council or International Education Board or New Guggenheim Fellowships. By 1932, the United States counted about 2,500 physicists, three times as many as in 1919. The Physical Review, the journal that has been to American physicists what Zeitschrift für Physik is to German, was considered a backwater publication, if not a joke, in Europe before the 1920s. It thickened to more than twice its previous size in that decade, increased in 1929 to bi-weekly publication, and began to find readers in Cambridge, Copenhagen, Göttingen, and Berlin eager to scan it the moment it arrived. Psychometricians have closely questioned American scientists of this first modern generation, curious to know what kind of men they were. There were few women among them, and from what backgrounds they emerged. Small liberal arts colleges in the Middle West and on the Pacific Coast, one study found, were most productive of scientists then. By contrast, New England in the same period excelled at the manufacture of lawyers. Half the experimental physicists studied, and fully 84% of the theoreticians were the sons of professional men, typically engineers, physicians, and teachers, although a minority of experimentalists were farmers' sons. None of the fathers of the 64 scientists, including 22 physicists in the largest of these studies, was an unskilled laborer, and few of the fathers of physicists were businessmen. The physicists were almost all either firstborn sons or eldest sons. Theoretical physicists averaged the highest verbal IQs among all scientists studied, clustering around 170, almost 20% higher than the experimentalists. Theoreticians also averaged the highest spatial IQs, experimentalists ranking second. The 64-man study, which included 22 physicists among its most eminent scientists in the U.S., produced this composite portrait of the American scientist in his prime. He is likely to have been a sickly child or to have lost a parent at an early age. He has a very high IQ and in boyhood began to do a great deal of reading. He tended to feel lonely and different and to be shy and aloof from his classmates. He had only a moderate interest in girls and did not begin dating them until college. He married late, has 2 children, and finds security in family life. His marriage is more stable than the average. Not until his junior or senior year in college did he decide on his vocation as a scientist. What decided him, almost invariably, was a college project in which he had occasion to do some independent research
to find out things for himself.
Once he discovered the pleasures of this kind of work, he never turned back. He is completely satisfied with his chosen vocation. He works hard and devotedly in his laboratory, often 7 days a week. He says his work is his life, and he has few recreations. The movies bore him. He avoids social affairs and political activity, and religion plays no part in his life or thinking. Better than any other interest or activity, scientific research seems to meet the inner need of his nature. Clearly, this is close to Robert Oppenheimer. The group studied, like the American physics community then, was predominantly Protestant in origin, with a disproportionate minority of Jews, and no Catholics. A psychological examination of scientists at Berkeley, using Rorschach and thematic apperception tests, as well as interviews, included 6 physicists and 12 chemists in a total group of 40. It found that scientists think about problems in much the same way artists do. Scientists and artists proved less similar in personality than in cognition, but both groups were similarly different from businessmen. Dramatically and significantly, almost half the scientists in this study reported themselves to have been fatherless as children. Their fathers dying early, or working away from home, or remaining so aloof and non-supportive that their sons scarcely knew them. Those scientists who grew up with living fathers described them as rigid, stern, aloof, and emotionally reserved. A group of artists previously studied was similarly fatherless. A group of businessmen was not. Often fatherless and shy, lonely, writes the psychometrician Lewis M. Terman, slow in social development, indifferent to close personal relationships, group activities, or politics. These highly intelligent young men found their way into science through a more personal discovery than the regularly reported pleasure of independent research. Guiding that research was usually a fatherly science teacher. Of the qualities that distinguished this mentor in the minds of his students, not teaching ability, but masterfulness, warmth, and professional dignity, ranked first. One study of 200 of these mentors concludes, "It would appear that the success of such teachers rests mainly upon their capacity to assume a father role to their students. The fatherless young man finds a masterful surrogate father of warmth and dignity, identifies with him, and proceeds to emulate him. In a later stage of this process, the independent scientist works toward becoming a mentor of historic stature himself." The man who would found big machine physics in America arrived at Berkeley 1 year before Oppenheimer, in 1928. Ernest Orlando Lawrence was 3 years older than the young theoretician, and in many ways his opposite, an extreme of the composite American type. Both he and Oppenheimer were tall, and both had blue eyes and high expectations. But Ernest Lawrence was an experimentalist from prairie, small town South Dakota, of Norwegian stock, the son of a superintendent of schools and teacher's college president, domestically educated through the PhD at the universities of South Dakota, Minnesota, and Chicago, and at Yale, with almost an aversion to mathematical thought, according to one of his proteges, the later Nobel laureate Luis W. Alvarez, a boyish extrovert whose strongest expletives were sugar and oh fudge. who learned to stand at ease among the empire builders of patrician California's Bohemian Grove, a master salesman who paid his way through college peddling aluminum kitchenware farm to farm with a gift for inventing ingenious machines.
Lawrence arrived at Berkeley from Yale in a Oreo flying cloud with his parents and his younger brother in tow and put up at the faculty club, fired compulsively with ambition for physics, for himself. He worked from early morning until late at night.
As far back as his first year of graduate school, 1922, Lawrence had begun to think about how to generate high energies. His flamboyant, fatherly mentor encouraged him.
William Francis Gray Swan, an Englishman who had found his way to Minnesota via the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism of the District of Columbia's private Carnegie Institution, took Lawrence along with him first to Chicago and then to Yale as he moved up the academic ladder himself. After Lawrence earned his Ph.D. and a promising reputation, Swan convinced Yale to jump him over the traditional 4 years of instructorship to a starting position as assistant professor of physics. Swan's leaving Yale in 1926 was one reason Lawrence had decided to move west. That and Berkeley's offer of an associate professorship, a good laboratory, as many graduate student assistants as he could handle, and $3,300 a year, an offer Yale chose not to match. At Berkeley, Lawrence said later, it seemed opportune to review my plans for research, to see whether I might not profitably go into nuclear research, for the pioneer work of Rutherford and his school had clearly indicated that the next great frontier for the experimental physicist was surely the atomic nucleus. But, as Luis Alvarez explains, the tedious nature of Rutherford's technique repelled most prospective nuclear physicists. Simple calculations showed that 1 microampere of electrically accelerated light nuclei would be more valuable than the world's total supply of radium, if the nuclear particles had energies in the neighborhood of 1,000,000 electron volts. Alpha particles, or better, protons, could be accelerated by generating them in a discharge tube and then repelling or attracting them electrically. But no one knew how to confine in one place for any useful length of time without electrical breakdown from sparking or overheating 1,000,000 volts that seemed to be necessary to penetrate the electrical barrier of the heavier nuclei. The problem was essentially mechanical and experimental. Not surprisingly, it attracted the young generation of American experimental physicists who had grown up in small towns and on farms experimenting with radio. By 1925, Lawrence's boyhood friend and Minnesota classmate Merle Tuve, another protege of W.F.G. Swan, now installed at the Carnegie Institution and working with 3 other physicists, had managed brief but impressive accelerations with a high-voltage transformer submerged in oil. Others, including Robert J. Vandegraaff at MIT and Charles C. Lauritsen at Caltech, were also developing machines.
Lawrence pursued more promising studies, but kept the high-energy problem in mind. The essential vision came to him in the spring of 1929, 4 months before Oppenheimer arrived. In his early bachelor days at Berkeley, writes Alvarez, Lawrence spent many of his evenings in the library, reading widely. Although he passed his French and German requirements for the doctor's degree by the slimmest of margins, and consequently had almost no facility with either language, he faithfully leafed through the back issues of the foreign periodicals night after night. Such was the extent of Lawrence's compulsion. It paid. He was skimming the German Archiv für Elektrotechnik, an electrical engineering journal physicists seldom read, and happened upon a report by a Norwegian engineer named Rolf Widerøe, Über ein neues Prinzip zur Herstellung hoher Spannungen, on a new principle for the production of higher voltages. The title arrested him. He studied the accompanying photographs and diagrams. They explained enough to set Lawrence off, and he did not bother to struggle through the text. Widerøe, elaborating on a principle established by a Swedish physicist in 1924, had found an ingenious way to avoid the high-voltage problem. He mounted two metal cylinders in line, attached them to a voltage source, and evacuated them of air. The voltage source supplied 25,000 volts of high-frequency alternating current, current that changed rapidly from positive to negative potential. That meant it could be used both to push and to pull positive ions. Charge the first cylinder negatively to 25,000 volts, inject positive ions into one end, and the ions would be accelerated to 25,000 volts as they left the first cylinder for the second. Alternate the charge, then, make the first cylinder positive and the second cylinder negative, and the ions would be pushed and pulled to further acceleration. Add more cylinders, each one longer than the last, to allow for the increasing speed of the ions, and theoretically, you could accelerate them further still, until such a time as they scattered too far outward from the center and crashed into the cylinder walls. Widerøe's important innovation was the use of a relatively small voltage to produce increasing acceleration. "This new idea," says Lawrence, "immediately impressed me as the real answer which I had been looking for to the technical problem of accelerating positive ions, and without looking at the article further, I then and there made estimates of the general features of a linear accelerator for protons in the energy range above 1,000,000 volts." Lawrence's calculations momentarily discouraged him. The accelerator tube would be some meters in length, too long, he thought, for the laboratory. Linear accelerators today range in length up to 2 miles. And accordingly, I asked myself the question, instead of using a large number of cylindrical electrodes in line, might it not be possible to use two electrodes over and over again by sending the positive ions back and forth through the electrodes by some sort of appropriate magnetic field arrangement? The arrangement he conceived was a spiral. It struck him almost immediately, Alvarez later wrote, that one might wind up a linear accelerator into a spiral accelerator by putting it in a magnetic field, because the magnetic lines of force in such a field guide the ions. Given a well-timed push, they would swing around in a spiral, the spiral becoming larger as the particles accelerated and were thus harder to confine. Then, making a simple calculation for the magnetic field effects, Lawrence uncovered an unsuspected advantage to a spiral accelerator. In a magnetic field, slow particles complete their smaller circuits in exactly the same time faster particles complete their larger circuits, which meant they could all be accelerated together efficiently with each alternating push. Exuberantly, Lawrence ran off to tell the world. An astronomer who was still awake at the faculty club was drafted to check his mathematics. He shocked one of his graduate students the next day by bombarding him with the mathematics of spiral accelerations, but mustering no interest whatever in his thesis experiment. "Oh, that," Lawrence told the questioning student. "Well, you know as much on that now as I do. Just go ahead on your own." A faculty wife crossing the campus the next evening heard a startling, "I'm gonna be famous," as the young experimentalist burst past her on the walk. Lawrence then traveled east to a meeting of the American Physical Society and discovered that not many of his colleagues agreed. To less inspired mechanicians, the scattering problem looked insurmountable. Merle Tuve was skeptical. Jesse Beams, a Yale colleague and a close friend, thought it was a great idea if it worked. Despite Lawrence's reputation as a go-getter, perhaps because no one encouraged him, perhaps because the idea was solid and sure in his head, but the machine on the laboratory bench might not be, he kept putting off building his spiral particle accelerator. He was not the first man of ambition to find himself stalling on the summit ridge of a famous future. Oppenheimer arrived in a battered gray Chrysler in the late summer of 1929 from another holiday at the Sangre de Cristos ranch with Frank. The ranch was named Perro Caliente now. "Hot dog!" Oppenheimer's cheer when he had learned the property could be leased. He put up at the faculty club, and the two opposite numbers, he and Lawrence, became close friends. Oppenheimer saw unbelievable vitality and love of life in Lawrence. Work all day, run off for tennis, and work half the night. His interest was so primarily active and instrumental, and mine just the opposite. They rode horses together, Lawrence and Jodpers, and using an English saddle in the American West, to distance himself, Oppenheimer thought, from the farm. When Lawrence could get away, they went off on long recreational drives in the Rio to Yosemite and Death Valley. A distinguished experimentalist from the University of Hamburg, Otto Stern, a Breslau Ph.D., 41 that year and on his way to a Nobel Prize, though Lawrence would beat him, gave Lawrence the necessary boost. Sometime after the Christmas holidays, the two men dined out in San Francisco, a pleasant ferry ride across the unbridged bay. Lawrence rehearsed again his practiced story of particles spinning to boundless energies in a confining magnetic field. But instead of coughing politely and changing the subject, as so many other colleagues had done, Stern produced a Germanic duplicate of Lawrence's original enthusiasm and barked at him to leave the restaurant immediately and go to work. Lawrence waited in decency until morning, cornered one of his graduate students, and committed him to the project as soon as he had finished studying for his Ph.D. exam. The two cylinders of the Widerøe accelerator have become two brass electrodes shaped like the cut halves of a cylindrical flask. These are contained completely within a vacuum tank, and the vacuum tank is mounted between the round, flat poles of a large electromagnet. In the space between the two electrodes, which came to be called Ds because of their shape, at the center point, a hot filament and an outlet for hydrogen gas work together to produce protons which stream off into the magnetic field. The two Ds, alternately charged, push and pull the protons as they come around. When they have been accelerated through about 100 spirals, the particles exit in a beam which can then be directed onto a target. With a 4.5-inch chamber and with less than 1,000 volts on the Ds, on January 2, 1931, Lawrence and his student, M. Stanley Livingston, produced 80,000 volt protons. The scattering problem solved itself at low accelerations when Livingston thought to remove the fine grid of wires installed in the gap between the Ds that kept the accelerating electric field out of the drift space inside. The electric field between the D edges suddenly began functioning as lenses, focusing the spiraling particles by deflecting them back toward the middle plane. The intensity then became 100 times what it was before, Livingston says. That effect was too weak to confine the higher speed particles. Livingston turned his attention to magnetic confinement. He suspected the particle beam lost focus at higher speeds because the pole faces of the magnet were not completely true, a lack of uniformity which in turn caused irregularities in the magnetic field. Impulsively, he cut sheets of iron foil into small shims, having a shape much like an exclamation point, as Lawrence and he would write in the Physical Review, and inserted the shims by trial and error between the pole faces and the vacuum chamber. Thus tuning the magnetic field increased the amplification factor from about 75 to about 300. Lawrence added, triumphant italics. With both electric and magnetic focusing, in February 1932, an 11-inch machine produced million-volt protons. It had a nickname by then that Lawrence would make official in 1936, cyclotron. Even in the formal scientific report to the Physical Review on April 1, 1932, he was unable to contain his enthusiasm for the new machine's possibilities. Assuming then a voltage amplification of 500, the production of 25 million volt protons would require 50,000 volts at a wavelength of 14 meters applied across the accelerators. Thus, 25,000 volts on each accelerator with respect to ground. It does appear entirely feasible to do this. The magnet for that one would weigh 80 tons, heavier than any machine used in physics up to that time. Lawrence, now a full professor, was already raising funds. In his graduate student days in Europe, Robert Oppenheimer told a friend that he dreamed of founding a great school of theoretical physics in the United States, at Berkeley, as it happened, the second desert after New Mexico that he chose to colonize. Ernest Lawrence seems to have dreamed of founding a great laboratory. Both men coveted success, and each in his own way, the rewards of success, but they were differently driven. Oppenheimer's youthful preciosity matured in Europe and the early Berkeley years into refinement that was usually admirable, if still sometimes exquisite. Oppenheimer crafted that persona for himself, at least in part, from a distaste for vulgarity that probably originated in rebellion against his entrepreneurial father, and that was not without elements of anti-Semitic self-hatred. Along the way, he convinced himself that ambition and worldly success were vulgar, a conviction bolstered nicely by trust fund earnings to the extent of $10,000 a year. Thereby, he confounded his own strivings. The American experimental physicist I.I. Rabi would later question why men of Oppenheimer's gifts do not discover everything worth discovering. His answer addresses one possible source of limitation.
It seems to me that in some respects Oppenheimer was overeducated in those fields which lie outside the scientific tradition, such as his interest in religion, in the Hindu religion in particular, which resulted in a feeling for the mystery of the universe that surrounded him, almost like a fog. He saw physics clearly, looking toward what had already been done, but at the border he tended to feel that there was much more of the mysterious and novel than there actually was. Some may call it a lack of faith, but in my opinion it was more a turning away from the hard, crude methods of theoretical physics into a mystical realm of broad intuition.
But Oppenheimer's revulsion from what he considered vulgar, from just those hard, crude methods to which Rabi refers, must have been another and more directly punishing confusion. His elegant physics, so far as an outsider can tell, his scientific papers are nearly impenetrable to the non-mathematician, and deliberately so, is a physics of bank shots. It works the sides and the corners and uses the full court, but prefers not to drive relentlessly for the goal. Wolfgang Pauli and the hard, distant Cambridge theoretician Paul A.M. Dirac, Eugene Wigner's brother-in-law, both mathematicians of formidable originality, were his models. Oppenheimer first described the so-called tunnel effect, whereby an uncertainly located particle sails through the electrical barrier around the nucleus on a light breeze of probability, existing, in particle terms, then ceasing to exist, then instantly existing again on the other side. But George Gamow, the antic Russian lecturing in Cambridge, devised the tunnel effect equations that the experimenters used. Hans Bethe, in the late 1930s, first defined the mechanisms of carbon cycle thermonuclear burning that fires the stars, work which won for him the Nobel Prize. Oppenheimer looked into the subtleties of the invisible cosmic margins, modeled the imploding collapse of dying suns, and described theoretical stellar objects that would not be discovered for 30 and 40 years, neutron stars, black holes. Because the instruments required to detect them, radio telescopes and X-ray satellites, had not been invented yet. Alvarez believes if Oppenheimer had lived long enough to see those developments, he would have won a Nobel Prize for his work. That was originality not so much ahead of its time as outside the frame. Some of this psychological and creative convolution winds through a capsule essay on the virtues of discipline that Oppenheimer composed within a letter to his brother Frank in March 1932, when he was not quite 28 years old. It is worth copying out at length. It hints of the long, self-punishing penance he expected to serve to cleanse any stain of crudity from his soul. You put a hard question on the virtue of discipline. What you say is true. I do value it, and I think that you do too, more than for its earthly fruit, proficiency. I think that one can give only a metaphysical ground for this evaluation. But the variety of metaphysics which gave an answer to your question has been very great. The metaphysics themselves very disparate. The Bhagavad Gita, Ecclesiastes, the Stoa, the beginning of the laws, Hugo of St. Victor, St. Thomas, John of the Cross, Spinoza. This very great disparity suggests that the fact that discipline is good for the soul is more fundamental than any of the grounds given for its goodness. I believe that through discipline, though not through discipline alone, we can achieve serenity and a certain small but precious measure of freedom from the accidents of incarnation, and charity, and that detachment which preserves the world which it renounces. I believe that through discipline, we can learn to preserve what is essential to our happiness in more and more adverse circumstances, and to abandon with simplicity what would else have seemed to us indispensable. That we come a little to see the world without the gross distortion of personal desire, and in seeing it so, accept more easily our earthly privation and its earthly horror. But because I believe that the reward of discipline is greater than its immediate objective, I would not have you think that discipline without objective is possible. In its nature, discipline involves the subjection of the soul to some perhaps minor end. And that end must be real if the discipline is not to be factitious. Therefore, I think that all things which evoke discipline, study, and our duties to men and to the commonwealth, war and personal hardship, and even the need for subsistence, ought to be greeted by us with profound gratitude. For only through them can we attain to the least detachment, and only so can we know peace. Lawrence, orders of magnitude less articulate than Oppenheimer, was also fiercely driven. The question is, what drove him? A paragraph from a letter to his brother John, written at about the same time as Oppenheimer's essay, is revealing. "Interested to hear you have had a period of depression. I have them often. Sometimes nothing seems to be okay. But I've gotten used to them now. I expect the blues and I endure them. Of course, the best palliative is work. But sometimes it is hard to work under the circumstances."
That work is only a palliative, not a cure, hints at how blue the blues could be. Lawrence was a hidden sufferer, in some measure manic depressive. He kept moving, not to fall in. To all these emotional troublings, Oppenheimer's and Lawrence's, as Bohr's and others before and since, science offered an anchor. In discovery is the preservation of the world. The psychologist who studied scientists at Berkeley with Rorschach and TAT found that uncommon sensitivity to experiences, usually sensory experiences, is the beginning of creative discovery in science. Heightened sensitivity is accompanied in thinking by over-alertness to relatively unimportant or tangential aspects of problems. It makes scientists look for and postulate significance in things which customarily would not be singled out. It encourages highly individualized and even autistic ways of thinking. Consider Rutherford playing his thoroughly unlikely hunch about alpha backscattering, Heisenberg remembering an obscure remark of Einstein's and concluding that nature only performed in consonance with his mathematics, Lawrence flipping compulsively through obscure foreign journals. Were this thinking not in the framework of scientific work, it would be considered paranoid. In scientific work, creative thinking demands seeing things not seen previously, or in ways not previously imagined. And this necessitates jumping off from normal positions and taking risks by departing from reality. The difference between the thinking of the paranoid patient and the scientist comes from the latter's ability and willingness to test out his fantasies, or grandiose conceptualizations, through the systems of checks and balances science has established, and to give up those schemes that are shown not to be valid on the basis of these scientific checks. It is specifically because science provides such a framework of rules and regulations to control and set bounds to paranoid thinking that a scientist can feel comfortable about taking the paranoid leaps. Without this structuring, the threat of such unrealistic, illogical, and even bizarre thinking to overall thought and personality organization in general would be too great to permit the scientist the freedom of such fantasying. At the leading edges of science, at the threshold of the truly new, the threat is often nearly overwhelmed. Thus Rutherford's shock at rebounding alpha particles,
"Quite the most incredible event that has ever happened to me in my life."
Thus Heisenberg's deep alarm when he came upon his quantum mechanics, his hallucination of looking through the surface of atomic phenomena into a strangely beautiful interior that left him giddy. Thus also, in November 1915, Einstein's extreme reaction when he realized that the general theory of relativity he was painfully developing in the isolation of his study explained anomalies in the orbit of Mercury that had been a mystery to astronomers for more than 50 years. The theoretical physicist Abraham Pice, his biographer, concludes, "This discovery was, I believe, by far the strongest emotional experience in Einstein's scientific life, perhaps in all his life. Nature had spoken to him. He had to be right. For a few days, I was beside myself with joyous excitement." Later, he told a friend that his discovery had given him palpitations of the heart. What he told another friend is even more profoundly significant. When he saw that his calculations agreed with the unexplained astronomical observations, he had the feeling that something actually snapped in him. The compensation for such emotional risk can be enormous. For the scientist, at exactly the moment of discovery, that most unstable existential moment, the external world, nature itself, deeply confirms his innermost fantastic convictions. Anchored abruptly in the world, Leviathan gasping on his hook, he is saved from extreme mental disorder by the most profound affirmation of the real. Bohr especially understood this mechanism and had the courage to turn it around and use it as an instrument of essay. Otto Frisch remembers a discussion someone attempted to deflect by telling Bohr it made him giddy, to which Bohr responded, "But if anybody says he can think about quantum problems without getting giddy, that only shows that he has not understood the first thing about them." Much later, Oppenheimer once told an audience Bohr was listening to Pauli talking about a new theory in which he had recently been attacked, and Bohr asked at the end, "Is this really crazy enough? The quantum mechanics was really crazy." And Pauli said, "I hope so, but maybe not quite." Bohr's understanding of how crazy discovery must be clarifies why Oppenheimer sometimes found himself unable to push alone into the raw original. To do so requires a sturdiness at the core of identity, even a brutality, that men as different as Niels Bohr and Ernest Lawrence had earned or been granted, that he was unlucky enough to lack. It seems he was cut out for other work. For now, building that school of theoretical physics he had dreamed of. On June 3, 1920, Ernest Rutherford delivered the Bakerian Lecture before the Royal Society of London. It was the second time he had been invited to fill the distinguished lectureship. He used the occasion to sum up present understanding of the nuclear constitution and to discuss his successful transmutation of the nitrogen atom reported the previous year, the usual backward glance of such formal public events. But unusually and presciently, he also chose to speculate about the possibility of a third major constituent of atoms, besides electrons and protons. He spoke of the possible existence of an atom of mass 1, which has zero nucleus charge. Such an atomic structure, he thought, seemed by no means impossible. It would not be a new elementary particle, he supposed, but a combination of existing particles, an electron and a proton intimately united, forming a single neutral particle. Such an atom, Rutherford went on with his usual perspicacity, would have very novel properties. Its external electrical field would be practically zero, except very close to the nucleus, and in consequence, it should be able to move freely through matter. Its presence would probably be difficult to detect by the spectroscope, and it may be impossible to contain it in a sealed vessel. Those might be its peculiarities. This would be its exceptional use. On the other hand, it should enter readily the structure of atoms and may either unite with the nucleus or be disintegrated by its intense field. A neutral particle, if such existed, a neutron, might be the most effective of all tools to probe the atomic nucleus. Rutherford's assistant James Chadwick attended this lecture and found cause for disagreement. Chadwick was then 29 years old. He had trained at Manchester and followed Rutherford down to Cambridge. He had accomplished much already. As a young man, two of his colleagues write, his output was hardly inferior to that of Moseley. But he had sat out the Great War in a German internment camp, to the detriment of his health and to his everlasting boredom. And he was eager to move the new work of nuclear physics along. A neutral particle would be a wonder, but Chadwick thought Rutherford had deduced it from flimsy evidence. That winter he discovered his mistake. Rutherford invited him to participate in the work of extending the nitrogen transmutation results to heavier elements. Chadwick had improved scintillation counting by developing a microscope that gathered more light and by tightening up procedures. He also knew chemistry and might help eliminate hydrogen as a possible contaminant, a challenge to the nitrogen results that still bothered Rutherford. "But I also think," said Chadwick many years later in a memorial lecture, "he wanted company to support the tedium of counting in the dark, and to lend an ear to his robust rendering of Onward Christian Soldiers." Before the experiments, Chadwick once told an interviewer, "Before we began to observe in these experiments, we had to accustom ourselves to the dark to get our eyes adjusted, and we had a big box in the room in which we took refuge while Crow, Rutherford's personal assistant and technician, prepared the apparatus. That is to say, he brought the radioactive source down from the radium room, put it in the apparatus, evacuated it, or filled it with whatever, put the various sources in, and made the arrangements that we'd agreed upon. And we sat in this dark room, dark box, for perhaps half an hour or so, and naturally talked. Among other things, they talked about Rutherford's Beccarian lecture. And it was then that I realized that these observations, which I suspected were quite wrong, and which proved to be wrong later on, had nothing whatever to do with his suggestion of the neutron. Not really. He just hung the suggestion onto it because it had been in his mind for some considerable time." Most physicists had been content with the seemingly complete symmetry of two particles, the electron and the proton, one negative, one positive. Outside the atom, among the stripped ionized matter beaming through a discharge tube, for example, two elementary atomic constituents might be enough. But Rutherford was concerned with how each element was assembled. He had asked himself, Chadwick continues, and kept on asking himself, how the atoms were built up. How on earth were you going to get the general idea being at the time that protons and electrons were the constituents of an atomic nucleus? How on earth were you going to build up a big nucleus with a large positive charge? And the answer was a neutral particle. From the lightest elements in the periodic table, beyond hydrogen to the heaviest, atomic number, the nucleus's electrical charge, and a count of its protons differed from atomic weight. Helium's atomic number was 2, but its atomic weight was 4. Nitrogen's atomic number was 7, but its atomic weight was 14. And the disparity increased farther along. Silver, 47, but 107. Barium, 56, but 137. Radium, 88, but 226. Uranium, 92, but 235 or 238. Theory at the time proposed that the difference was made up by additional protons in the nucleus closely associated with nuclear electrons that neutralized them. But the nucleus had a definite maximum size, well established by experiment, and as elements increased in atomic number and atomic weight, there appeared to be less and less room in their nuclei for all the extra electrons. The problem worsened with the development in the 1920s of quantum theory, which made it clear that confining particles as light as electrons so closely would require enormous energies, energies that ought to show up when the nucleus was disturbed, but never did. The only evidence for the presence of electrons in the nucleus was its occasional ejection of beta particles, energetic electrons. That was something to go on, but given the other difficulties with packing electrons into the nucleus, it was not enough. And so, Chadwick concludes, it was these conversations that convinced me that the neutron must exist. The only question was how the devil could one get evidence for it? It was shortly after that I began to make experiments on the side when I could. The Cavendish was very busy and left me little time, and occasionally Rutherford's interest would revive, but only occasionally. Chadwick would search for the neutron with Rutherford's blessing, but the frustrating work of experiment was usually his alone. His temperament matched the challenge of discovering a particle that might leave little trace of itself in its passage through matter. He was a shy, quiet, conscientious, reliable man, something of a neutron himself. Rutherford even felt it necessary to scold him for giving the boys at the Cavendish too much attention, though Chadwick took their care and nurturing to be his primary responsibility. It was Chadwick, remembers Mark Oliphant, who saw that research students got the equipment they needed within the very limited resources of the stores and funds at his disposal. If he seemed dour and unsmiling at first, with time, the kindly, helpful, and generous person beneath became apparent. He tended, says Otto Frisch, to conceal his kindness behind a gruff facade. The facade was protective. James Chadwick was tall, wiry, dark with a high forehead, thin lips, and a raven's beak nose. He had, say his joint biographers, colleagues both, a deep voice and a dry sense of humor with a characteristic chuckle. He was born in the village of Bollington, south of Manchester, in Cheshire, in 1891. When he was still a small boy, his father left their country home to start a laundry in Manchester. Chadwick's grandmother seems to have raised him. He sat for 2 scholarships to the University of Manchester at 16, an early age even in the English educational system, won them both, kept one, and went off to the university. He meant to read mathematics. The entrance interviews were held publicly in a large crowded hall. Chadwick got into the wrong line. He had already begun to answer the lecturer's questions when he realized he was being questioned for a physics course. Since he was too timid to explain, he decided that the physics lecturer impressed him and he would read for physics. The first year, he was sorry, his biographers report. The physics classes were large and noisy. The second year, he heard Rutherford lecture on his early New Zealand experiments and was converted. In his third year, Rutherford gave him a research project. His timidity again confounded him, this time almost fatally for his career. He discovered a snag in the procedure Rutherford had recommended to him, but could not bring himself to point it out. Rutherford thought he missed it. Man and boy found their way past that misunderstanding, and Chadwick graduated from Manchester in 1911 with first-class honors. He stayed on for his master's degree, working with A.S. Russell and following the research in those productive years of Geiger, Marsden, de Hevesy, Moseley, Darwin, and Bohr. In 1913, taking his Master's of Science, he won an important research scholarship that required him to change laboratories to broaden his training. By then, Geiger had returned to Berlin. Chadwick followed, which was a pleasure while it lasted. Geiger made a point of introducing Chadwick around so that he became acquainted with Einstein.